Willkommen zum Podcast der Initiative Regenerative Marktwirtschaft. Hier wollen wir herausfinden, wie eine umweltfähige Zukunft machen.
Welcome today to this new episode of our podcast for the Initiative for the Regenerative Market Economy. And for me, it's early, and for Levin, it's late. Levin is in Canada, and that's just as much as I'm going to reveal now, because we want to hear from you, Levin. Yeah. Who are you? And welcome, of course.
Thanks so much, and thanks for the invite, and thanks for spending time together as your kind of preliminary breakfast and my kind of beautiful ending of the day. I'm originally from Belgium. So Levin is a Belgian little Asterix and Obelix guy that only moved over to Canada now about 8 years ago. And I think it's important to mention that. And so who is Levin? Levin is a person, a dad from six children. It's a special, beautiful team behind, having a big heart also. And that was urgently in need after film. A career of what, 25 years also to resource with myself, to resource with Earth and planets and nature and community. And I've been a social entrepreneur for a few decades. I've been a teacher, professor in business schools, and I was longing for simplicity again. So that brought me over to Canada. It brought me over to a little tiny island here, but only 20 minutes away from downtown Vancouver, half an hour. So I'm really, really fortunate. I feel like it's a blessing that we could live on a simple life with a community of 4,000 people practicing whatever we want to bring in the world. And so I'm still very actively engaged across the world. We can talk further about it and how to bring communities together and how to try making an impact to what truly matters. But being able to do that from a place where community is key, an island is a community. You're in a, it's very funny how people living long ways start to call it, it's an argument embodied by water. So where it's always discussions emerging, but it's from a heart, it's from a place where you definitely belong because otherwise you're not here. And so it needs also, you have to deal with the shit that brings together as well. And but once a week, I can see a whale, once a week, I see other things. So there's a very close connection to spirit and nature here. And that's living, being connected, but also being entangled in many different little pockets in the world on social entrepreneurship, impact. What does it mean to be community, and knowing that this will be a quest until the end of my life. Well, it's me. Yeah.
Part of you. Let's find out some more. You said you were longing for simplicity again, which implies that there was simplicity before. And let's find out what's the shape and the quality of that simplicity is that you were longing for, that you were seeking to pull into the future, but that came from the past. What's that?
You are a very good listener, Thomas. So thanks for picking that one out. Because it's an important question to me. Where was life still simple, and how did it become complicated? I think there's different levels of answering that question, but what I think the most truthful answer is, there's many truths to that, is like my life, the paradox, my life became complicated from the moment I tried to change the world as I saw it was. And so when I was following the flow, and I had been raised in a conscious family with a brother and a sister and with active people and also active parents. And my life runs really well in studying and following my adventures in the being with Outer Bounds and working as a consultant, becoming a teaching professor. I think, and to say, until the birth of my second child, Amber, who came to life in a very complicated way physically. So with a lot of surgery, who also appears to be what's so beautiful in English and in this part of the world, a special needs.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was also my angel. And so my life, my eyes opened up to see, like, until that moment, and I was, I think, 32 when I became a dad from Amber, 33. Everything went for granted. And I, whatever I believed in, I could serve the race, but nothing was evident anymore with Amber. The solutions, mm-hmm. the magic solutions didn't work. So I had to find something else that was not mainstream. The way, so we had to then combine the needs for a classical university hospital to keep her alive, but also we needed acupuncturists and we needed people working with energy, because otherwise we would have had a dead plant in our hand. So it was a big wake-up call. And because of seeing how many things we take for granted that didn't work for Amber anymore, my eyes opened up, but there was no point of return. So, and that's been the secret. Yeah. Go ahead, Demos. Yep.
So I'm trying to understand, listening for the simplicity in that. And to me, it seems that there, through that experience with Amber, you detected a layer of maybe unnecessary complexity in the way we have decided to handle things in that small and weird part of the world where we both come from and live. And that there is a intelligence, simplicity, a luxurious simplicity somewhere else that is more like a felt sense than something that you had experienced and you were felt drawn to that. That's approximately right.
Well, the situation with Amber became really complicated in our world and in the world I lived in, mm-hmm. with the medical system, with the way we could approach these things, and what brought radical simplicity in that moment. I still remember Amber was 3 months old, that I went into a Vipassana retreat, that brought me to the inherent simplicity I knew I lived in all of my life, being close to myself, being close to spirits, being close to just breathing and the facts of daily life. And that apparently I was living a life where I was doing conscious things. I was in all of the things you should do as a social entrepreneur, doing good for the world, etc. Mm-hmm. But by living quite a lot of these patterns that were not working for Amber anymore, I said, oh, wow, this is not simplicity. The real simplicity mm-hmm. is in being truly connected to oneself, to my own breath, and then I could see it through the cracks.
Mm.
Then my whole thing opened up. As a little child, I was always in nature. Mm. My connection with nature was profound and made me smile and made me a happy child. And so I could rediscover that. I needed to rediscover that in order to be an anchor for the mm-hmm. development of my second child and my community around me. And that changed with myself profoundly. So that was a reawakening, Thomas, mm-hmm. of little childhood, but also a wake-up shock of, oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Although I'm living a conscious life and I see myself as a change maker, I'm also following many patterns that apparently, if they don't work anymore, life is strange. And it brought me to be another change maker, to be there for what truly matters in life. And that's mm-hmm. connection, that's relationship, mm-hmm. connection mm-hmm. to each other, that's surrender to what we don't know. And that's, mm-hmm. And that has been very, very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Although it also made me become a fighter against the injustice I saw that didn't work around, for example, Amber, that didn't work in energy systems, et cetera, et cetera. And that brings me to a second part of the story, but that's for later. Yeah.
And you hope to find that on an island on the other side of the world. How did that happen? Because I know you found it because you spend time in nature a lot. And the first time we we had a conversation. We were both sitting in nature and you were just coming back from your early morning run with your friends. And the family was waking up in the background, and it was I could sense the embracing beauty of the place. But how did that happen? How did you find that?
What happened from the moment, from I think 1.5 years or three years after Amber's birth, and the gratitude that she was still alive. I made a big switch in my life with me, my then new partner in life, also still my wife, Bates, is to really live the uncompromising life we believed in. We started the retreat center in Belgium, where we really wanted to bring everything together. Regeneration in the lands, bring the food from our property, place where business and where development, personal development and business and social development and business come together. Been successful there, but after that we started another place where we brought together co-housing, where we brought together the same principles. And I started also working with governments, with the commission, on how can we change principles and rules. And what happened by the paradox of, again, the same, from doing all of these things, I was entangled in so many different initiatives that I lost the simplicity. That I became again a fighter, instead of a person living from a great grateful space and a little space at being. So some of my friends tell me, you're running away from something you need to solve here. Other friends could concretely see you going back to your roots by going to nature in a small place. And so what it brought me was three things. I was at a quest for nature, and I could find nature in its most profound way. It's peaks. It's not community or people first, it's nature first. I missed that in Europe already for a while. It's community first, because here it was beautiful. I could be part of a community instead of being leader of a community again. That brought simplicity for me. And I was up for some inspiration. In my coaching, I tried a lot of executive coaching. Always when, what I say to people, when you see and you hear yourself repeating the same story, it's time for a change. And I was repeating my same story in wherever place I came. So it was time for a mental change also, to be inspired from another place in the world. So that's why the move to this place. And it was just a crazy intuitive step. We were planning to move from Belgium to the Netherlands, which is just like a drop away. And it didn't work out for 2 years. And then in 4 months time, we moved from being here the first time. 4 months later, we were here with our four children. So it's... yeah, so that's and did that become simple? It brought me to simplicity in the daily practice in life, and also in the way I lived after these 7-8 years. It's been a hugely complex journey in these 8 years. It's been not an easy one. And I think exactly because I was so close to the simplicity and the rawness of life, it also brought to me a lot of raw insights on where things really, where suffering is present, and where good change needs to happen in society. And that's not an easy path to be on, Thomas. That's why we got together.
And I can even sense that that seems to be the big story of your life, the balance between the simplicity and the big complexity, because you're pulling yourself into complexity as we speak. I know that from the plethora of amazing things you're preparing and building. But you're on a bounded system. You're on an island. You chose that maybe for intuitive reasons, but it really lends itself to confronting complexity, like you said, right? There's a wall of water around the thing, and it keeps everything in, the beautiful and the ugly, right? And so you have to deal with it. So in that, you experienced really firsthand what it means to be part of a closed system and needing to deal with that closed system. And which, of course, you don't only do there, but and have done in the past and are doing in the future. But in essence, I understand that you're concerned with bringing people into a space where they can actually find out what they are about, what they want to do, around themselves, so that they can be agents in the world together as a coherent whole. And I'm curious of how are the principles that you apply to help a group of people that is incoherent, that is maybe more in the ugly in their bounded space than in the beautiful? How do you help them take those steps towards coherence? What's your way of doing that?
I want to relate it to the first question we explored together also, too, was a question regarding simplicity, because it's so beautifully you picked out of that work. I think in the most profound, simple way, it's about, and it's also become for me my kind of mission in life, my tagline when I wake up, is about trying to reconnect what truly belongs together. If you are in a space where it can, where it could be, where you just can listen to what's going on, and then it's I admire the way you bring value to our conversation. An island makes, I didn't see it yet like that, but an island makes it easier to listen what truly belongs together, because like there's a real boundary between what's in and out. Mm-hmm. And I believe what makes it easy here is to whoever you listen to, whether I'm in the pub or I'm drinking coffee at the place, all these places are connected, because there's only 5 to 10 social places on our island, and that's it. So the chance is that if you really want to meet somebody and you just wander around 2 or 3 of these places, the chances you meet somebody you know is 90 to 100%. Mm-hmm. If you're then open enough to truly listen and just have a coffee, you can feel the heartbeat of what's going on in that person, and maybe already in 10% of the island on that day or that week. And so how to tap into that is about being really present. So I had a beautiful this weekend, we had a beautiful journey with some friends also in exploring, and just being present with what is there, being open enough to listen to people and not being judgmental on what plays a role, helps a lot to start sensing into the coherence and the incoherence between people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I bring it also to the question you just raised. How do I apply that in my work, in the work outside in the world? It's like wherever I arrive, I think the big shift that I made, again, it's not, don't arrive with a bag full of topics you want to pull upon people. Come with an open heart and an open mind and an empty bag that you want to fill with what's at stake for them. And the art of deeply listening to people, even when you're a kind of stranger to them. But I think, and then the one additional piece that I start to realizing again, then having the art of connecting the different stories to each other and coherence in the opposites is the way where true coherence in whatever group starts to happen. It's so important to have that skill set of listening without any judgment to what people bring forward. And the coherence is a frequency. Coherence is a frequency from the heart. And the art is to listen to that frequency and start weaving the words that belong together, together, but without taking the words away from the people. And I think that's where simplicity emerges. It's a deep practice to be present like that, but it's in fact very, very simple once you do that. And then it's allowing the space, like what I call also a trusted space. It's allowing the space and that people can see, oh, wow, here, and you use the word coherence, but there's something in the middle here. There's a common ground emerging. So and why are we here together? So nurturing conversation and create and planting the seeds for a story that can unfold. That's where true coherence emerges, even when on the surface, there's conflicting opinions because that's something completely different.
So it feels to me, the way you're describing this, that it is a playful remembering in a sort of way. And I just love the way you say, you weave the words without taking them away from the people. That is a very, very powerful image. Yet this ease, this playfulness, requires a deep grounding in oneself and a deep letting go. And that's why I said it feels like a remembering, because that's deep groundedness and playfulness. It feels almost childlike to me, right? It's like stepping back into a space where I am not full of opinions, but I'm more on the learner side. I'm more trying to figure out the world. So I'm observing much more closely and more in tune with everything. Is that right? And B, the hardest thing, I mean, you just glossed over it. Say, we just have to listen. that's the hardest thing. So how do we get to that place? How do we get to that place of being able to listen and weave those words without taking them away from the people?
It's deep learning there for me, Thomas, has been like, when I started also, I started very young also doing the research work at the university, at the business school. And the whole topic there was on multi-actor collaboration. And we were working a lot alongside with some UK university and US university, the whole concept of common ground. And what I realized in the last 20 years, like then the whole mission of simplicity, common ground, is we need to more and more say that very, very literally. What is our common soil, common ground that connects us? And for me, that's so true. If we would see that as a personal skill set, it's tough, especially in a world full of noise. When there's too many words, too many stories, they're all opposing. So what the hell is truth? And so it's so beautiful what Yuval Harari just also described. Like, the hardest thing we have in reality right now is finding truth in all of this noise. But if you go back, and so what I started realizing, when you go back to place, physical place, place-based approaches, it helps us so much to have the right conversation. And if we can see that, the tagline on reconnect what belongs together, it's within ourselves, but it's also we as individuals we've always been, and it's remembering, it's going back to childhood, but it's also going back to or when we were children, we lived differently and our previous generations lived differently and we were place-based. We were defined and also by the boundaries of our community and things happened there. So going back to that and help people reconnect to the place where they live right now. And we might be nomads, but we all live in a house or in a space. We all live there in sync with either the tree or the coffee shop around the corner or our neighbor or whatever. But convene the stories around what makes me feel that I belong here or just and disconnected to that is a conversation of common ground, emotionally, mentally, but also physically. And so what helps a lot also for us, because I truly believe the deep listening is a skill set we all have innately. We just lose it because of the noise around us. So if you approach it from that angle, I don't have to step into a group where we first have to do 3-4 training weeks of helping to train people to listen again. No, we need to create the conditions so that listening can emerge from a place that is really a connecting and a belonging space. And I do believe that place-based connection, where truthful communities happen, and there's two things, it's really place, physical place, but also team-based connection. So topics that truly bring people together in a strong way. These are the magnets that evoke the best out of us again. And that's also where that frequency of coherence can emerge. And in our world, in our society, in order to ground it, I think it's so vital that we also look to data, to science, to research, and bring what Bateson so beautifully describes, that we make, that we help people be informed on what truly matters to them. So the whole approach of warm data instead of just doing statistics. But then you start evolving and building community. Then you start bringing people back in again. And then step by step, you create a condition again of belonging. But that's only the start, the first start. That's the conversation. That's the energy. The next step is really what you see. But then how to build governance and minimal structures and principles around it so that you can hold that with each other. That's mm-hmm. as big as hands. But that's the kind of... That's a condition mm-hmm. next to once this happens, you can work mm-hmm. on it.
I see all of that. So you're describing the process. It helps that it's grounded. Yet what are the preconditions for somebody to be able to hold that space, that grounded, that space in which the group can ground physically, emotionally, and mentally, because that requires both to be fully present and engaged and in that space too, so you can actually sense the topics and the commonalities in which the group could be grounded and highlight them and bring them to the fore so that they can be a thing, become a hyper object that the group attaches itself to next to the ground they're in. So be fully in, but at the same time, let go. So is that, that's the tension I'm feeling that is needs to be resolved in the person facilitating. Yeah. And I'm wondering, do you have thoughts on what a person could do to become that, to step into that, to be able to hold that ambivalence?
That's a good question also, Thomas, because I hope we can make it very practical. So like right now, referring to either the island or to some work we do right now in Amsterdam or some work I'm doing in Washington State here, being awake is a very important one. And I literally mean being awake, being on edge. And so what you see is it makes no sense to come into communities where there's no either urgency or desire, when people are asleep and just live the life as I did before Amber was born. To just come back to the first part of our story, it's very hard to then have these conversations because we want to be in a kind of status quo that we are not really aware of, but bringing in either something that is truly shitty for people or truly exciting mm-hmm. or going more mm-hmm. to the extent mm-hmm. people get nervous and get energized, either out of frustration of losing out mm-hmm. or out of excitement to say, wow, this is key for me. And like mm-hmm. housing is a very specific topic on that. So we have a big crisis here on housing, but it's also the same in the Netherlands when there's and the need for proper housing, like also now here, there's no housing. There's no housing that people can afford. And so there's now, and the city, it's even worse, becoming worse right now. And it was the big title in the newspaper this weekend. We are building houses nobody can still afford. Mm-hmm. Oh, which was with the crisis that there's more than 2,500 units now getting empty, standing there empty. And there's people living on the street because they cannot afford. So there's really a huge gap. Mm-hmm. And even on our island, there's new houses that need to be built, but there's also people wanting to protect that we don't become a fully built island because we are one gem of nature. So we are on the protected reserve. So that spikes conversation that makes this mm-hmm. argument surrounded by a body of water and bringing fully alive. And mm-hmm. so then people are awake. Then going from opinions to deep conversation, that's the true art. But that's the moment where you can do that. And what it needs in the middle, Thomas, it's important. It's a very important question. Is these opposites emerge either out of fear when you're excited, when you're fearful because, oh, shoot, what will we do? Will they be in my backyard? Or will they build in such a way that my property will lose value for half of the price? So when you're in fear, you are not in a position to deeply listen. When you're in excitement and full of excitement, you're also not in a position to truly listen. So the discovery we made also into our project is, what is the space of well-being and true person resilience? Where and bringing the language and the narrative into well-being and resilience and help also bring that in is a common ground where everybody wins with. And bringing in the topic that is building on those foundations of community well-being, on health, on personal resilience or fear, fight, flight, and then bringing that in the middle to then talk about what does these topics or do these topics mean for us? That creates a kind of common ground of understanding both the opposites, from why do we speak from either anger or either too much excitement trying to convince. So the art of bringing true resilience and health and habits in and talk from a space where we truly care, where care and belonging is key. So these are minimal values, I suppose, that I'm evoking now, that connect people. That's a very important one. And we've seen that through COVID times, and it didn't go away on our island. So there's been created a small social system. It's called NERP. So the neighborhood emergency response community, so of program. And in every neighborhood here on the island, we were 4,500 people. There was one person that became the kind of facilitator, coordinator for all of the neighbors. So whatever happened around emergency responses, she or he had all of the phone numbers. She knew how to contact. She knew conditions of the people. So in a magical way, all of the neighborhoods were connected through these people, and all of the individuals were connected in their little circles through these people from the whole island. What was hard is, like, from the moment COVID passed away, there was no emergency anymore. So keeping to nurture that is an important one, but everybody is still connected in one way or another. And so now bringing in, we have a big issue here also with climate change, the whole risk we have on fires and then forest fires and et cetera is huge. So now being fire smart as a community, everybody is fully awake for that. That's something that reconnects everybody again. So having these conversations brings you together, and now being that, but also health. And mental health been bringing us tremendously together as a community, nurturing that again. And so we gradually also fed in with topics that are at stake for everyone. And now you see like that pulse is there. So we have the kind of amplitude to now talk also about the topics that are really, really important to create some change and transformation. Because we know we train the muscle of talking about the things that truly matter for us also on a daily basis. Is it a little bit what I say?
Yeah, absolutely. I think at least. Let me try and pull it together so to see if I understand it. But what I'm hearing is actually three things. So creating safety, a safe space. You didn't use that word, but I think that's what's somewhere in there. So creating a place where true expression becomes possible, where people aren't afraid to express and aren't afraid to hear what's being expressed, which also is a way to say, and maybe the groundedness in place is a factor here, and that if you find a way for people to help people as a group to downregulate their sympathetic and upregulate their parasympathetic response, that once you step into that space, you might still understand everything that was activating you before, but you see it in a much more relaxed way and in a more holistic way, right? You're four times more effective when you're in relaxation response rather than stress response. That's one. And then while you were speaking, there was a picture emerging about curiosity and forced curiosity. Essentially, that hard moments that we all encounter are simply moments where life forces us into curiosity mode. And I found that very interesting, and had a really helpful insight a couple of years ago when I helped a young lady with her master thesis at a business school in Berlin. And she was interested in mindset complexity and how to help people into and stay there in high mindset complexity situations. And we did a measurement of mindset complexity with the Hart-Hill method. And the person who came out highest in mindset complexity, he's a friend of mine. He's also stated that he had never really experienced hardship. He was always just curious about life.
Wow.
So that comes through as well, right? So that maybe hardship can force you into curiosity. We have to figure out how to solve the situation, but then you have to find a way to stay curious, right? So that you don't hit the next wall that will then force you into curiosity. Just stay curious, right? Like you were as a child. So that's what I'm hearing. Is that roughly representative?
If I connect them, not to become too theoretical, but what we derived from our experiences also is the model, and through the research we did, is like your heart. It's so beautifully you use the word heartfelt, because heart means connection. You can, again, to go back to reconnect. And if you can first install, that's also if connection can first appear within yourself, and also you feel at ease, because what you say about sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system, that's exactly what happens. When you feel at ease and you trust the space, you step into calming down, resting, but then the connection just happens with all of the other people. So for us, in all of the approaches we have with the communities we work with, and it's now quite a lot in the Netherlands, it's about with cities across the globe around decarbonization, it's how can we connect the most important stakeholders around these topics first with each other and build true bonds so that there's a safe space. Yeah. And exactly from a science perspective, we also do resilience assessments together with the resilience institutes. We can see how well, and it's a direct relationship. People that have bad resilience are exhausted or worn out, but we can train that so easily. Insights there, and that's also like for connect, it's the growth part. So when people are connected, we bring in matters and materials and insights that really matter for all of them, so that they can grow from that space. And that growth together, so that personal growth in safety, in trust, in capacity, collective capacity is the kind of preliminary condition as a second stage also, to then be able as a community to direct yourself into a new direction. So, okay, if we have this capacity, if we have this bond, if we are really connected to each other and to what matters here for us, how can we now choose direction? And what would that direction look like? And quite often we start with strategic plans and we start with, okay, and now we're going to work on these topics. But if these preconditions, to use your previous words, these are really the necessary preconditions, connection with each other, with oneself, having growth as a community before charging it with topics and contents, grow from within, from the inside out, as a collective, to then have the capacity to grow from the outside in and bring the outer challenges on foods, on even resilience, on housing, on energy, or whatever happens there. If you want to embrace it from a truthful space, then you need to have these preconditions ready. And then you can direct, then you can bring in the mental space, then you can bring in data on what should we do. But then also, because if we want to do it from a regenerative point of view, if we don't want to do it as we are used to do it, because that's mostly leading to disconnection again. It's mostly leading on, okay, the government will do that, the municipality will do that, businesses will step in through that. And I'm just an employee. No, I'm becoming a neighbor again. So I create a kind of I'll drop out. So if you want to remain in that space of capacity, that space where that's fertile soil, where that newness can happen, we need these things in place. But then true magic can happen, because then I also see it our role as true as in this space, to then once people direct themselves, that we are ready at a global scale or at a broader scale to supply them also with community-based solutions. We think that they can take agency over. And there's such a plethora of possibilities and potential nowadays, but it needs to land in the right preconditions for flow. Mm-hmm.
And you also,
And then they can go. And that's the last stage in our kind of four stages we really use rigorously in working with these communities. Then going is, and then connecting it with finances, then reconnecting it also with solutions, then become operational is a kind of outcome of all the pre-work I just described, just by the ritual. Yeah.
And you see four stages. I see two phases in those four stages. One is the first phase is about getting that coherence and clarity in the group and then starting to go outside, right? And you're working on both ends. So now we've talked about the first phase. I'm really curious about hearing all of the stuff that you're working on, envisioning and building towards in the second phase, actual changing of reality, the agency in the world for the people who have found and grounded themselves as a group. What are you seeing there?
Well, that's a beautiful question, and also that's an ongoing challenge, Thomas. Mm-hmm. And I want to build it upon what you really capture again in an excellent way. I truly believe, and then a close friend of mine in Belgium, he's UK based, he's Belgian based, but he's UK. He calls it the crossing. And I call it working from the inside out and the outside in at the same time. But it's you, but just people won't see that. But the way you did it with your hands, it's such a beautiful way of summarizing what I just shared. And it's good. It's for me not two phases. It's bringing two different worlds. It's building bridges between two different worlds that need to come together. Mm-hmm. But it's again that coherence, that frequency of that it is ready to match, come together, creating that readiness is key. And to give a very practical example, again, building on the housing story, we are working now on an exciting project, and it's quite big. So the people there, they own 1,100 acres of land. So that's approximately 700 hectares, something like that, 600-700 hectares. There is a permit and a zoning already for, there's quite a lot of houses already built. There's a perspective and an approval for another 700 units. So that's a village of the future they want to build, but it's completely stuck. Because like at the place where we live right now, building is too expensive. Pricing is too expensive, so this and so this that fit needs to be resettled. The way we work on that right now, and also that's where they came across and reached out to us, like to find new solutions. It's at that systemic level, also again reconnect what belongs together, and give an example on housing, which is true for many places in the world. We have a multi crisis around housing. It's not about the cost of building. It's about climate that is involved. It's about the cost of the materials and the cost of the way we build and making that sustainable. But it's as much a financial crisis, because who owns most of the houses? It's the banks. It's mortgages. And so the expense of a house and the houses being too expensive is also due more to the financial system and the way we pay for housing than by the house itself. And then land has become our most important asset. So the fact that land has become something that we can own privately is a big shit show, has become a big shit show. And I know you live for a big time of your life also in Costa Rica. It was so precious there a few months ago. I live in a place where I'm so amazed on how government really tries to work through its reconciliation of bringing land back to First Nations. But like where the whole seven generation principles, where land just belongs to the ones that first lived on the lands and are giving nature. That's also what we do right now. So how to build these community land banks, how to build community land ownership and so on. And then how to also bring in the hands of the people a new operating model where they can start owning this in a way that it brings value to the community and not only to individuals. And so there's some puzzle pieces there again, that all of these solutions exist somewhere in the world. There's nothing that needs to be invented there. But again, they are disconnected. They are not there together. And where we fight for right now is like, it's so easy if you see it, just bring them together and execute. But then we don't take into account that there's different regulations here in Canada, and that there's incredible, beautiful technology that's coming out of Sweden right now and Germany. And we know if we import it here, we can build for about 50% cheaper. But it's not approved. It's going to take another 3 years before approval and all of these regulations can be met. So what we do right now is really like the urgency is so high. No, there's a need. But we are now creating what we call a living lab around it, so that we bring in all of the parties again, reconnect what belongs together, both of governments, of regulatory, of technology providers, of landowners, to collectively build on the solutions for the future by building, not by talking, not by inventing, but by building houses and see how we can manifest how it should happen in order to solve this crisis. Now, it's a long answer, but it's very, very practical on, because we know if we do this well for these 700 houses, we create a revenue model for the owner again, because it's stuck anyhow. We create a solution that we can scale to the 100,000 houses that are needed in our province now in the upcoming 10 years. But you create it in small circles of meeting. And we create it also with contracts of these stakeholders that need to work together and hand in hand. And it makes me very excited because it's real.
So you glossed over the really, really hard part, but you then closed it with a solution really for that hard part, which is you say, okay, do people get into coherence? Okay. But then we also have to have the counterpart, the systemic lock-in that is creating the urgency into coherence, right? And that is practically impossible in my experience. But you say, we don't even have to do that. If we create a membrane that allows the system and the actors in the system to feel safe and get into coherence with the group, then inside of that membrane, we can let things flow more easily, and it just becomes a lot easier to have a lab membrane to run some experiments and see that it's either fast track the regulatory process or widen the regulations because they might be outdated or whatever the case may be, right? So is that a useful description?
There's one problem with our conversations that I want to have another conversation very soon because
that's not a problem.
I was skipping that part unconsciously because I'm heavily frustrated on that end. And let me explain why. And that it's also what we touched upon when we also talked the last time is during my whole career and life, I've been focusing on the preliminary conditions for change is the systems changing the conditions in the system that right now are expressing themselves as a need. We had a system that worked for a long time and brought a lot of success and beauty to our planet. Also, now we need to level up, and we all know that. But to just make you a witness of a conversation I had on Tuesday that hugely frustrated me, but also hugely excited me. So that's the two things. Where I brought also my pitch of our whole work with social architects of meaning. That's the movement that I'm leading. It's also the executive team we have in place. It was all on, we are the ones creating the systemic conditions underground, creating the fertile soil for initiatives, manifestations on housing, oil blended finance, on energy systems to emerge. And the person I talked with is, I love him dearly. He's been hugely successful at his new venture, which is organization, and growing it from 3 people to 29 people working now together also in 1.5 years time. So they are very successful in scaling clean tech startups and supporting these organizations. And he said it bluntly, and I won't mention his name right now, but I could. But chat, and it's also Climador, here located in Vancouver. He said, McEwen, I'm here because I long constantly for that wisdom on systems change.
Yeah.
I didn't bring my two partners with me. because there's only 1% in the world, in the business world and society, that truly understands what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and that's why my partners are not here, because they don't truly understand what you say, but I'm eating it. Mm-hmm. But there's one issue. You also need capital. Mm-hmm. We want to raise capital. You're doing big things right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid, he said, you are the one that has the strongest connections to that 1% that might understand with money what you truly do.
Mm-hmm.
And not till the black night. And said, that was my frustration of that day. However, he said, but what you are doing on housing right now, the story I just shared with you, Thomas, mm-hmm. also was the real project that we are working on, said, Lieven, with that manifestation, that practical example, the way you can transform housing there, there's billions that want to mm-hmm. flow in there to solve that nasty problem. If you dare to trust that if you now create safe conditions, to use your word, Thomas, to give a solution to that, and with all of the credentials and your national, international network, you have these credentials and you start from there, I promise you now that if there's a preliminary investment that isn't taking place, which is there, I can trip to fold it in 2 months' time because there's such a need from the cost. And so I was both very excited because I went home with much more than I expected, but a completely different angle than what I've been working on for many, many years.
Mm.
And both one of my impact investors friends that I have a deep respect for, Piet Koolrijk in Belgium. Piet also spent millions and millions from his impact investment money in developing the new pioneering organization that would change the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I never forget 3 years ago when we had lunch somewhere in Belgium, when I was there for a trip. I'm so happy because I switched gears. I challenged one of the big banks to bring a very simple financial product that would solve the issue around sustainable building at scale.
Mm-hmm.
Make them under the conditions that they launch it as a product that I would also provide capital with our impact ecosystem network. And in 2 years' time, I've accomplished more in investing in sustainable housing than I've did in the 10 years before. And so I bring the two stories together upon what you said. I'm skipping the most important parts. I have a deep question for our ecosystem of entrepreneurs, because I feel you like brother acting from the same space.
Mm-hmm.
Do we trust ourselves as social entrepreneurs and systems change agents enough that we don't have to talk about it anymore, but that we have the wisdom and the strength to tap into the pressing issues at stake and change from the outside in by bringing in the change from the inside out, to come back to what we discussed. And my shocking experience from this week at seeing that there's an abundance of means that can flow through us. And I talk millions and millions and millions, as long as we tap into the pressing issues. But that we have the trust that we create safe boundaries, like the living lab, like an alliance, like whatever, to solve it in a way that it's not hijacked by the old system.
Yep.
What is then the actions we need to take as a collective?
I find it incredibly useful to think of that frame of the 1% who get it. And because that, I think it comes back to what you said earlier about coherence, the ultimate, and I think maybe even only tool to create conditions in which the traditional conventional system doesn't hijack the new ideas is trust. You can, I don't think you can try, and there might be some hacks, but I don't think really legal frameworks provide what we need to create that foundation, that shift, that resource flow into the projects that is needed in a way that they cannot be hijacked. This has to come from a kind of resource source that is internally liberated, that is and maybe even willing to be, maybe in some cases even willing to let go of the money, because, and that is a really important part that I learned from what Marie Ekelund is doing with Ekelat, or is doing with 2050. She's allocating a certain percentage, I think it's 10% of the funds, really conventional funds, impact oriented, of course, like everybody, but 10% to nonprofit activity. Because the nonprofit activity is part of the ecosystem. It is required. You need to have free infrastructure. So that's the new modality can start emerging. It's a bit like if we all know streets, right? We've all had to deal with the street before in our life, but it's a bit like water to fish. We don't notice them. But almost no business that you can think of right now is possible without those things. Right? And there is infrastructure, and you're working on the psycho and social infrastructure and on the physical infrastructure for a regenerative way of doing things. It just doesn't exist yet. And just like streets are commons and water needs to be commons, is that infrastructure also needs to be a commons. So some of that money needs to understand that, and you will only find it in the 1%, I think.
Yeah, and then that's true, Thomas, but what we have to ponder around is the pace of change we need right now will not happen by only accelerating and igniting 1%. And so what is it that we as a community of change makers need to do in order, because what you say about trust is vital, to trust ourselves enough and our deep connection through what needs to happen in the future, that we are open enough to include the people that are there for 70%, so that we can build some in-between stages towards the commons, towards making infrastructure commons again. And so, do we dare to trust that if we build some versions that might not be perfect yet, but are much better that we do them less perfect, but we do them and we scale them already, than not doing it at all? How much can we permit there? And for me, the whole, not only idea, but the whole way of looking at it, also what are now no regret actions we can take that don't harm the future we need to see, but that we need right now in the way building upon to that ideal future is a very important one. And that's also because there's this, in reality, now when I look to the projects we now do together with Urban's Transition Mission, we work with the cities to bring their decarbonization portfolios to life. There's billions needed right now. So we have direct access to portfolios that want to have billions in order to invest in sustainability. These projects are not perfect yet. Now stepping into, again, a kind of living lab structure where financiers that's go over these billions. And there's frontrunners like pension funds. There's frontrunners like Norwich, when I look to Norway, when there's really money allocated. And that's even more than a trillion over there, that they say it needs to be regenerative. It needs to be in, it's all going to go in assets and infrastructure. How can we also there again reconnect what belongs together, build bridges of trust, so that it lands into a portfolio that is not perfect yet. But if we already have some cities doing that with the means we have now, we build foundations to even improve that for the future much faster and waiting for the ideal pilot we create. And I think both go hand in hand. I think how can we use them, the means and the profits we create by doing that, by investing them immediately in the most ideal pilots we can then implement again. And so, do we dare to dance with that? And and I also see that the fear that we are in the midst of a high level of fear everywhere. It's very simple. For me, I need to travel to New York next week. It's the first time ever that I don't feel safe to travel to that bloody country.
Yep, I agree.
And there's reason for that, but at the same time, how not to act from fear, how to be so excited with all of the possibilities we have in our hands. And I truly believe by now daring to be the ambassadors for change in what is already possible now, and know that in the background, we build further as a collective on the next level solutions by already implementing in a no regret way what we need to do and can do now. That's the best thing that can happen. And we are in a disruptive time. So I also believe being very present with that coherence energy globally, meditating, sensing a lot on where we truly are, things accelerate hugely through all of the things that happen around the world. And so we might be surprised that through all of the fear and the war and the dreadful things that happen, it creates fertile ground for things to accelerate hugely that we didn't expect before also.
Yeah. Yeah, the push into curiosity, really, right? And again, what I'm hearing is, what if we were really clear and open about the fact that nobody knows? But instead of trying to know, we create membranes, labs of exploration and learning very, very quickly, because there is a lot of resource wanting to help solve the plethora of issues. But the problem with that is it can only be deployed once, maybe, right? So it wants to deploy in the correct way. And it needs to have that safety, that security, that trust that this is the right way. And the only way to understand that is by running experiments and being really clear about, we don't have a solution. We have an experiment. Let's find it out here and then maybe move on with the next one. That's what I'm hearing, the approach to unlocking.
I would like to reverse two things to us.
Okay.
Because the consequence of what you say is, what if we could all acknowledge that we don't know? Is in most of the cases passivity. And I truly believe, coming back to what we shared in this conversation, what if we all could acknowledge that we do know, but that we need to remember again that we know. And that from that inside out, if we come in sync again with our place of living, with our community, that we can collectively remember what truly matters. So we know. And if we have that wisdom evoked again and say, but me, guys, you all know, but we forgot, or there's so much mist and fog in our minds and there's so much sand in our eyes that we need to clear up again. Let's clean the shit out of our eyes. Let's just be awake again. Let's talk about so that we can see also, at the other hand, there's so many solutions to the table that have potential to solve all of our major challenges. If we use them in the right way. And I never forget Tom Chi is one of he's one of the Google X founders. And he went to these things and he said 4 years ago, leaving. And it's also, he said it in a podcast as well, but I met him personally. It's enormous and it's so beautiful what happens with the exponential evolution of our technology. There's only one success factor that we cannot forget. We will only be successful in using these technologies and solutions in the right way if our consciousness as human species grows exponentially with it. And that consciousness is old. Our wisdom is ancient, is sacred. Or it's only about remembering. And it's about connecting us to that memory. If we then can use that wisdom, that collective wisdom, to use the technologies what we have for good, then know that we cannot use trees three times. But once we cut them, we then know immediately that water is not infinite, but that we have to take care. We then know if you had three forest fires that you see the smoke coming over and you then know that you have to be careful and find for other. So, and then our collective capacity shifts immediately. And so that's two switches that empower us as a society much more. And that changed our role drastically. Instead of the ones working really, really hard to convince others, we are there to create that space for others to wake up and then bring the solutions to them in a very technical, economical way, but then economitas in the old way, the reciprocal way of bringing service to each other. And that can happen fast. And I believe we are truly also at that place, but that's a completely different point of view than the scarcity thinking that we don't take care that we evoke also with our approaches.
I agree. Yeah, you're right. Tom is extraordinary. He's definitely one of those very, very, very few who see that and who can have the ability to bring together multiple versions of resources into a coherent flow. But I want to pick up on something you said earlier, and I think you already pointed to it multiple times, but I want to give it a proper frame. There's this matrix that we sometimes use, this 4x4 of known and unknown things, right? And we talk about the known knowns and the known unknowns and the, of course, unknown unknowns, but everybody seems to ignore the unknown knowns, right? And you just pointed in that direction. And I believe that there are unknown knowns that are deep insights that we already carry, but aren't at the surface, aren't accessible to us because they're subconscious. And if you use that frame and help us see maybe one of those and see which one of those would you like us all to start seeing so that we can begin to become what part of that 1%? What would you say there?
I think it's one of the most beautiful questions you can raise, Thomas. And it also acknowledges what we just shared. Like, there is that wisdom. And for me, if there's one I have to choose, I believe it is the one of belonging. We all belong. Full stop. And if we, and that's an unknown known, we all know that very deeply in ourselves, innate, from the moment we are born, we know that we belong. But from the moment we are born, it's a whole process of starting to forget that we belong. We become different from our mom. We become separate from our parents when we go away. Then we become separate from our house because we work on another place. So we start to disconnect from the belonging. And so for me, the unknown known is we all belong. The biggest crisis today that we have is the crisis of loneliness and mental health right now on a global scale. If we could all start remembering that we all belong, and how that's one of my 6 habits in a day. So I have my 6 rigid habits and points of and the third one is my most important bullet, Thomas. And it is make one person that I don't know smile and happy a day. And I started that as not as a joke, at a little experiment, but I was blown away with the impact on myself because once you have to start looking to somebody you don't know. But second, almost everybody responds to that. Third, the glow you feel in your body, if somebody responds to it with that smile, and you don't even need a conversation, but there's something happening in your body. Thomas, it's so simple, but so crazy profound that it's addictive. And if we could plant that seed, and now Judith is doing it, even my kids, because they know 6 things. Even my kids practice it. And when they are coming home grumpy because something, so I have teenage girls and boys and all, and they come home grumpy. And I say, how was bullet 3 today? But that's for me the simplest form of making the unknown known of we all belong. And that's also why I'm making the circle round, why it's been so special for me to have the privilege of now living in a very pristine place in nature, to feel, wow, I belong with nature. And that's my big desire. If we could if that could be the fuel for us as the 1%, that we believe that everybody belongs, so also that we are not different from the 99%, but that makes our life so much easier of not being seen ourselves as the outcasts or the ones that know it all, or the ones that don't know it at all because older, and or the ones without power because we are not in political. No, we all belong. Mm-hmm. It's for me the kind of little magical bell for now.
Mm-hmm. I just want to round it off by tying it to place, because you mentioned place as a really important thing. And yeah. The layers of abstraction we've put between ourselves and place by getting our food not from the land but from the supermarket, and our clothes, our houses, and all of that, we feel the longing for the same belonging to place as we feel to people. So I really love that frame of belonging. Beautiful.
And I love you, and I love the way you now connected to place again, because that's the essence. I really believe, and this also, you touched me deeply by tapping into my lifelong learning will be the balance between simplicity and complexity. That's where you took me from the first moment in the conversation. And I'm so grateful for that, because living a simple life requires a lot of practice.
Yeah.
And I think we really tapped into that during this conversation, and to rediscover that we belong to place summarizes it all. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you. Thank you for being here and spending your precious late evening with me here today.
I'm afraid I'm fully awake, Thomas. So thank you so much.
Sorry. I'm fully awake too, and that is really good, because it's early in the morning and I don't need coffee this morning because of our conversation, because I'm fully alive and awake now. Thank you so much.
Thanks for holding the space for this. You're a very, very precious person, and I'm really happy that we get to know each other.
Thank you. Thank you for all the work you do on behalf of all of us. Thank you.